This is February 14th, 2010, and for Teisho today, I'm going to look at the one part of the Prajnaparamita, the Heart Sutra, which is arguably the preeminent text in all of Zen Buddhism. I'll be reading from a fairly new book called the Heart Sutra, which was has a translation. It was translated with a commentary by an American translator by the name of Red Pine. He begins this book by saying in his introduction, "The Heart Sutra is Buddhism in a nutshell. It covers more of the Buddha's teachings in a shorter span than any other sutra, and it does so without being superficial or commonplace." It goes on to say, although the author is unknown, he was clearly someone with a deep knowledge of the Dharma and an ability to summarize lifetimes of meditation in a few well-crafted lines. Having studied the Heart Sutra for the past year, I would describe it as a work of art as much as religion. And perhaps it is one more proof, if any were needed, that distinguishing these two callings, art and religion, distinguishing them is both artificial and unfortunate. I'm going to focus on the five skandhas. I spent most of my Zen career chanting this part of the Prajnaparamita with only the dimmest, vaguest understanding of what skandhas were, and I can't be the only one in that category. So you know how it begins. We all know how it begins. The Bodhisattva of compassion, that's Kanon, the Bodhisattva of compassion from the depths of Prajna wisdom, out of his deep enlightenment, saw the emptiness of all five skandhas. And with that, sundered the bonds that create suffering. The five skandhas really is just a way of saying everything. The Kanon saw the emptiness of everything. But it's the style of Indian Buddhism and to some extent all of Buddhism to articulate to further articulate these broad categories, these terms that would otherwise be dull and abstract, like everything or everywhere. We also, in our chanting, recite 10 directions, 3 worlds. That's just a way of saying everywhere and everything. Throughout time and space. But somehow there is this there's this fondness for breaking it down into articulate it further like that. It's the same with the skandhas. Skandhas really means everything. So Kanon saw the emptiness from the depths of her wisdom, saw the emptiness of all of everything. But it's interesting that the Buddha broke it down into these five skandhas. So I'll just begin here with this one line. The translator here says, "The reason Buddhists focused on the five skandhas is that they provide everything we need in our spiritual explorations. They are not only equivalent to what we normally think of as ourselves, they are equivalent to the entire universe as we experience it. That's that last clause is important, as we'll hear as we go along, because one thing that awakening reveals is there's no so-called universe out there apart from us and our experience of it. You can't separate subject and object, the experiencing subject, that is the I or the we, from that which is apprehended or experienced, the so-called world. They provide, the five skandhas provide everything we need in our spiritual explorations. Even though it's everything, it's often translated, the five skandhas are often defined as the aggregates of the self or the personality. And the reason for that is that, he says, the word skandha, the Sanskrit word skandha refers to the trunk of a tree. And he says, and I think the trunk of a banyan, ficus indica, might have been what the Buddha had in mind when he started using this term. Now, this is really fascinating. The banyan is one of the world's most unusual trees. It begins as an aerial root that descends from a seed dropped by a bird in the canopy of another tree, such as a palm tree. So it grows down from the branch of a tree. After it sprouts, its roots descend until it reaches the ground, and once established, it strangles its host. As it continues to grow, its branches put forth their own aerial roots, and these in turn form additional trunks. In the course of 100 years, the original trunk becomes impossible to distinguish among the grove of roots that develop into trunks. In Sri Lanka, there is a banyan that has more than 350 major trunks and 3,000 minor ones, and that forms its own forest. Thus, the banyan is called the tree that walks. The Buddha frequently sought shelter within the wide, outstretched root structure of such trees. And we know from so-and-so's commentary on such-and-such that from a distance, a skandha was sometimes mistaken for a human being. Hence, it is not surprising that the Buddha chose a word like this to refer to this host-strangling root that looks like a person. But instead of seeing the individual as a single skandha, the Buddha saw five skandhas as he considered a person's experience of the world from five different perspectives. So what is in most texts is where skandha is defined as an aggregate or a heap or a pile. Five heaps or aggregates might more accurately be defined as events, the five events that comprise the not just the individual but the world. And that's what it says. The Buddha appears to have been alone. He developed this concept of the five skandhas. He appears to have been alone in analyzing the individual and the individual's experience of reality from five points of view. The fact that he often had to explain what he meant by the five skandhas suggests they represented a form of analysis not widely known even to the disciples of other teachers. Well, for those of us who have had so much trouble getting our minds wrapped around the five skandhas, this is a little bit of a consolation. He had to himself explain these many times to people. And then Red Pine goes on here. In his use of the word skanda, the Buddha views the universe of our awareness as supported by these five trunks or pillars, or as consisting of these five aspects, which are separate in name only, and each of which exhausts everything of which we are aware from a different point of view. So they represent a system of analysis, he says, designed to find our actual bodies or individual selves. And again, that means not a self that is ultimately separate from the rest of the world and our experience of ourself and the rest of the world. So the first of the five skandhas is form. He says the Sanskrit word is rupa. Rupa is not the material world. It is simply the outside world in contrast to what we presume is an inside world. Thus, the word rupa, or form, does not actually refer to a concrete object, but to the appearance of an object. Always we have to acknowledge that it's the appearance that things give, based on our own mind. As we say in the chant, affirming faith in mind, that things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. So there's no cushion out there apart from our perceiving the cushion, our experience of the cushion. He says, form is like a mask that cannot be removed without revealing its own illusory identity. Such a mask might be worn by a table, or a sunset, or a number, or a coin, and he has in parentheses the rupee, or a universe. Whether such things are real is not relevant. The important thing is that they make up a presumed outside to a presumed inside. He goes on, in the Buddha's system of analysis, the skanda of form includes not only appearances, but also the means by which those appearances are apprehended. Thus, form is not an objective category, but a subjective one, extrapolated from a person's own experience, and beyond which it has little meaning, if any meaning at all. In order to substantiate the existence of an external world, and thus to prove the existence of an inner one, a means is needed whereby that external world can be known. So the Buddhist definition of form then includes the powers of the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, and the skin, as well as the domains in which they function: sight, sound, smell, taste, and feeling. So rupa, or form, is not limited to what we normally think of as our body. It includes the sun and the wind, and the oak tree outside the window, and the window, and whatever else we might find in and through the five senses. So this is a huge category, isn't it? It's just for the purpose of this analysis, it divides the outside and the inside. So form really includes everything that we may think of as outside us and the appearance of it and so forth. And then the Buddha further analyzed these different aspects of form and the perception of form as representing different combinations of the four elements: earth, water, fire, and air. These are already part of the general discourse in the Buddha's day, and his inclusion of them was more like sugarcoating for the materialist members of his audience. And then the translator says, essentially, form is a conceptual category established in order to give meaning to mind. Form does not represent a separate reality outside of mind, merely a stage on which to proceed with the analysis. Thus, with the backdrop of an outside established, the Buddha continued with an analysis of the inside, which he divided into four additional skandhas. Well, these are the other four. Let me pause here and point out that in our chant, where we say feeling, thought, and choice, consciousness itself, these terms of the other four, start first there's the form, and there's feeling, thought, choice, and consciousness. Those four are loose, sometimes quite loose translations of the original words, because they were chosen to make the chant sound better. We'll get to each one individually here. So he divided into four additional skandhas. These were apparently developed from the second half of an earlier bipartite division of reality into nama rupa, name and form. According to this twofold scheme, rupa, or form, refers to the things we know, namely the outside world, while nama, or name, refers to the means by which we know the things we know, namely the inside world. From a Western perspective, this might be interpreted as division into matter and mind, but it was more of a division into objective mind and subjective mind. One of the reasons this is so difficult, such difficult material, is because of our conditioning by which we, in our Western culture, have come to see an inside world and an outside world, or mind and matter. And that's different. Seeing mind and matter, seeing it divided that way, is different from what he says here, division into objective mind and subjective mind. This is why mind in Zen texts, mind is often spelled with a capital M to include everything, so-called inner and outer, so-called subjective and objective. It's a fundamentally important thing to bear in mind that really these are just convenient designations, and there is no way to tease apart mind and matter, or inside and outside. It's just a certain way we've constructed realities, dividing it that way. But the Buddha himself now is going along with this, but from his point of view, it's just a convenient way of talking about two different aspects of mind, the so-called outside and the so-called inside. So in now turning his attention to name, or the subjective world, the Buddha began his analysis of subjective mind with sensation. He made this the second skanda. So here's where the first example of where we use feeling in our chant rather than sensation. I suppose this translation that we use was adopted before I came to the center. But it makes sense that, you know, feeling is a two-syllable word rather than sensation. When you start piling in multiple syllable words into a chant, it can get pretty dense and cumbersome. So I appreciate that these little license was taken to find more simple words. So the word, the Sanskrit word for sensation or feeling, was derived from vid, meaning to know or to experience. And this was used by Buddhists to refer to our evaluation of form. Once one establishes the existence of form, that's the first skanda, sensation necessarily follows as the interface between name and form, between inner mind and outer mind. None of the skandhas are separate in any sense other than as analytical constructs. They merely represent different ways of looking at the same experience. The skanda of sensation or feeling looks at our experience as a process of evaluation. This is not the same as sensory input, but rather the evaluation of input, which the Buddha rarely described in any more detail than positive, negative, or neutral. For the most part, our experiences are neutral and ignored. But certain experiences appear to satisfy a need or pose a danger and are classified accordingly. As we walk through a forest, our eyes take in countless appearances, but we quickly focus on a snake or a wildflower or some object that might affect our continued existence. Thus, Buddhists do not understand sensation as the passive collection of data from an outside world, but as the active sorting and grading of appearances and their transformations into objects according to categories supplied by the third skanda. Now, before we get to the third one, what we chant as thought, let's just appreciate this a little bit more. In non-Zen meditation, this sensory data is used a lot more, broken down to, I know in Vipassana meditation, this is one form of Vipassana meditation where you do a body scan, you look at your body and its different parts, and what you're feeling. Let's say you're feeling cold, and then you notice that you're evaluating that as negative, bad, uncomfortable, and in this way and with everything, and you become more aware of this process of evaluation or judging experience. And then part of meditation experience is coming to see how arbitrary and how ego-centered our evaluations are, based on just our likes and dislikes, or what we experience as positive or negative or neutral. So let's say, let me just come up with some examples here, besides wildflowers and snakes, just in seeing the world of form, people, men, women. And it's not just the seeing, the passive collecting of data, but it's then evaluating people we find attractive, people we find unattractive, colors, same thing. We evaluate them. The third skanda is perception, or what we translate as thought in our chant. Like sensation, perception was also included as a subcategory of the earlier concept of name, the four subjective categories. The word, perception, the Sanskrit word is sanjna. The word sanjna is derived from san, meaning together, and jna, to know, and refers to our experience as a kaleidoscope of conceptual combinations. Without the skanda of perception or thought, our sensations cannot be classified as positive, negative, or neutral. Perception supplies the framework that allows us to make such judgments, as well as the framework that allows us to objectify or subjectify our experience. It also supplies the means that allow us to manipulate our sensations so that we see what we want to see and don't see what we don't want to see. This is the kind of humorous shorthand for this in Buddhist circles is to say believing is seeing. You know that old saying, seeing is believing. Okay, if we see someone standing in front of us, then we believe it. But in Buddhism, we turn it around. We can turn it around and say that what we believe, our mental framework, our notions, determine to a certain extent what we actually perceive. So we see what we want to see and don't see what we don't want to see. Thus, sensation is dependent not only on the skanda of form, but also on the skanda of perception. And likewise, the skanda of perception is dependent on sensation as well as the fourth skanda, which is the source of its seemingly never-ending supply of conceptual constructs. So they're all five skandhas, of course, again, are all linked because they're all one thing. It's only categories. The fourth skandha is sanskara, which I have translated as memory. Now, this is the skandha that... whether there's the most disagreement in terms of translations. In our chant that we do, we call it choice. Nice single syllable word. But it's more commonly translated as volition, meaning will. Impulse is the second one that you often hear. But he's calling it memory, and he explains why. The word sanskara is derived from a combination of san, together, and kri, to make. Thus it means put together, and refers to those things we have put together that have a direct bearing on the way we think or perceive. In the past, this term has often been translated as impulse, volition, predisposition, or mental conformation. But each of these renderings involves certain limitations and distortions. For example, volition, or will, suggests a separate will tantamount to a self. Once you say will, then it implies a self which wills. And impulse implies the lack of any will or self. Predisposition comes closer, but does not necessarily establish a connection with past actions. What this term basically refers to is our karmic genome, the repository of all that we have previously intended, whether expressed in the form of words, deeds, or thoughts. Thus, sanskara embraces all the ways we have dealt with what we have experienced in the past and that are available to us as ways to deal with what we find in the present. And so he comes up with memory as a suitable translation. He quotes a certain guy I've never heard of, Monier Williams, as defining sanskara as the faculty of memory, mental impression, or recollection, impression on the mind of acts done in a former state of existence, the reproductive imagination, a mental conformation or creation of the mind. So let's see if we can make this more accessible. You could also use the word conditioning, that because of our experiences as children with our siblings and with our parents, we develop this certain memory conditioning that causes us to perceive the world. Again, we see what we want to see and don't see what we don't want to see. We perceive the world in a certain way and evaluate the data of our senses. It's maybe what in the Chinese text is sometimes called subjective emotional consciousness. And this is going on all the time. To anyone who is paying attention, you will see this happening all the time throughout our daily lives. Our interactions with people at the supermarket, our interactions with people we work with, interactions certainly with our children, with our parents, with our siblings. It's never just a clean, clear, perfectly empty, that is clear, response to what is being said or done. It's responding or reacting to people and events based on this baggage that we carry with us. That maybe is not a bad translation, informal translation of Sanskara, the fourth skanda, is the baggage we bring to each moment. He goes on here, under the skanda of sanskara, there are 52 kinds of habitual behavior patterns, such as intelligence, belief, shame, confidence, laziness, pride, anger, envy, sloth, repentance, doubt, anything that might provide us with a prefabricated set of guidelines from the past with which to perceive and deal with the world, both inside and outside, as we experience it in the present. Thus, the skanda of memory, or what we call choice or impulse or will, supplies the templates that perception applies to sensations and form. In Zazen, we become aware of all the ways that we distort reality through this baggage, this template that we bring to it, and how much misery, how much trouble we get into by distorting and misinterpreting what people say and do, and our own thoughts, thoughts and feelings. And then he says, and how do we know this? How do we know that the skanda of memory supplies the templates that perception applies to sensations and form? Because we are conscious of it. And that's the fifth skanda, consciousness. That also, consciousness is also a pretty dry, abstract word, but the translators of our chanting version of the Prajnaparamita, clearly couldn't find anything, any suitable equivalent for consciousness, so we use that in our chant. consciousness, the Sanskrit word is vijnana, and the vi in vijnana means to divide. So vijnana is often translated as discrimination. In terms of the skandhas, this vijnana, or consciousness, refers to the faculty of the mind in general, the ability to be aware of anything, but always something, form, sensations, perceptions, memories, and, of course, a self. It is the least discussed of the skandhas because to discuss it would be like the hand trying to grab. Essentially, consciousness refers to our ability to establish the states that memory recapitulates. But if we stop to consider these five pillars that support our awareness, it becomes clear that the Heart Sutra presents them to us backward in order to make them easier to grasp for those whose understanding of reality begins with the material world. So in terms of the world as we actually experience it, we begin with the skanda of consciousness. Of course, we can't experience anything without consciousness. And then extrapolate the memory of previous states of consciousness, from which we then extrapolate perceptions, from which we extrapolate sensations, from which we extrapolate an objectified world of form. And then he summarizes. Basically, the skandhas represent an attempt to exhaust the possible paths we might take in our search for a self, for something permanent or pure or separate in the undifferentiated flux of experience. They are five ways of considering our world and looking for something we can call our own. This is why the Bodhisattva of Compassion looks upon the five skandhas. The five skandhas are the limit of reality. If we are going to find anything real, this is where we're going to find it. But no matter how often or how long or how intently we search through the skandhas, we come up empty-handed. Thus, the skandha of form is often compared to foam because it cannot be grasped. The skandha of sensation to a bubble because it lasts but an instant. The skandha of perception to a mirage because it only appears to exist. The skandha of memory to a banana tree because it has no core, and the skandha of consciousness to an illusion because it is a well-concealed deception. And yet, he finally says, the skandhas are not separate from what is real. This last thing can be so confounding. Roshi Kapo would often say, the world of the senses, our true nature is beyond the world of the senses, but not separate from them. But it's the same with the other four skandhas. Our true nature is beyond the world of consciousness, but not separate from it. The same with these other skandhas. Thus, he finally says, it is important to keep in mind that the skandhas include everything we think of as real, and not just our physical body. They include five possible bodies, each of which is limited in extent only by our awareness and our willingness and ability to differentiate. And he quotes Edward Kanza, who is one of the early translators of Buddhist texts into English, as saying, the first step towards wisdom consists in getting the skandhas into view. This requires considerable knowledge, practice, and skill, but it is the indispensable basis for all that follows. Well, in Zen we have a different way. Kanza, it sounds like, was probably referring to getting a clear intellectual understanding of the skandhas. And I think to get some greater clarity on them has some value, and hence this Teisho. But in Zen, our way is through direct experience, that all of these categories, the ways that we classify these skandhas, are all just to help us understand more our direct experience of our minds and of our inner mind and so-called greater mind that includes the so-called objective world. That's where we really focus on in Zen, of course, is the practice, the direct experience of all of these categories. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.